Hey, everybody, it's Kai. This is the Corner Office Podcast, my interviews with CEOs who run some of the most significant companies in our economy today. Thanks for listening to this episode. It's Arne Sorensen, the CEO of Marriott. And for this conversation, I met up with him in New York City.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
This is the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton just off Central Park. What it sounds like anyway at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. The thing you need to know before we get into this too far is that as of last year, Marriott is the biggest hotel chain on the planet by, like, miles, because it merged with another company, Starwood. So if you're staying at a Westin or a Sheraton or a SpringHill Suites or a Ritz-Carlton, you are, in fact, staying at a Marriott hotel. The whole deal was presided over by Arne Sorensen, only the third CEO in that company's history. And it was quite the big deal that his last name wasn't Marriott.
Always been looking forward to
talking to see you.
Meeting the Scandinavian.
Yeah, I know, right? I thought the same thing. Yeah. You don't find too many Arnes out there. We heard you walk in a couple of minutes ago. What were you doing? Poking around? Looking to see how things were going?
I stayed here last night.
Stayed here last night?
I did stay here last night, yeah.
Do you ever stay, like, at the courtyard around the corner where I'm staying?
I stay. Are you staying where the Courtyard Residence Inn combo?
Yeah,
on Broadway?
54th, yeah.
Yeah, I've stayed there, of course. I love that hotel.
Tell us where we are, first of all.
Well, we're at the Ritz-Carlton Central Park South, which is 59th and 6th Avenue. It is a stunning little jewel in a great location, obviously, right in the middle of Manhattan. We've got two hotels on Central Park South. We've got this one, and we've got the Essex House.
Yeah, I didn't know you guys had the Essex House.
Both I personally love in part because at this time of year, it's nothing like a run in the park to start the day.
Yeah, did you get up and run this morning?
I did not because I had a meeting at 7. So,
I read someplace you're on the road at 200 nights a year.
Something like that, yeah.
I mean, I get it because it's kind of your job, but that must kill you.
I love it.
Really?
I absolutely love it, yeah. And, you know, I've got some tricks for travel. It does get you down occasionally.
Well, so give me the Marriott CEO's secret tricks to travel. Because
always be on local time.
So you get up at 6:30 in the morning and go to bed at regular time?
Always get natural light. Always exercise.
Yeah.
And those are probably the three most fundamental.
Yeah.
And, you know, depending on whether you're going east or west, it's a little different. Going to Europe is easy for me because you leave the East Coast at 8-9 o'clock at night, you can get four hours of sleep, and actually you hit the ground running, you're fine.
Yeah.
Asia is a tougher one because it's a 14-hour flight,
going
maybe
the
15-hour flight, and my approach there is to stay awake the entire way.
Wow, that's tough.
Which is a bit of a endurance contest, but then you often get there about 9 at night, exercise, go to bed, you're so exhausted you sleep, and that gets you through the week.
You are not a hotel guy from the get-go, were you?
No. I'm a reformed lawyer of all things.
How'd you wind up, first of all, in this company and then now running it?
Well, one day at a time. It's been a tremendous privilege to be able to do what I get to do at Marriott, and I still learn from it. But I went to law school coming out of college because I didn't really know what I wanted to do.
I thought
about law school as being a place to get trained in a way that would allow me to do a few different things. I ended up practicing law for about a dozen years and represented Marriott during the sort of final stages of that when Host Marriott and Marriott International were separated from each other. Still a deal that's taught in business schools all around the country. And got to know the team well out there. Mr. Marriott said, come on out to Marriott. I said, okay, why not?
So, since you just said it, and I've seen it in interviews that you have given, you run this company, and yet you still call the guy whose name is on the building Mr. Marriott.
I call him Mr. Marriott to you.
Yeah?
Yeah. He is a good friend, and he's a mentor. I don't call him Mr. Marriott when the two of us are talking together. But I'm in awe of him and what he's built, and I think he deserves that respect.
How come you got this job?
That's a good question.
Take all the time you need.
Part of it is timing, in truth. There have been great leaders that have come through Marriott over the last 90 years. I know the lodging era better than the restaurant era, which preceded that.
Yeah.
And the lodging era is about 50 years. But some extraordinary transacting people, some extraordinary operators. But they came through at a time when Mr. Marriott was still vigorous and running the company and wasn't going to give up the CEO gig. When I'm there, okay, he turned 80 when I took over in 2012. Yeah. It was time, in his view, to make a change. And I was in the company and had been working by his side at that point for 15 years and learning as much as I could learn from him.
But I guess the question is, your last name is not Marriott.
It's not. No, that's right. That's right. And that obviously wasn't required.
You are, apart from maybe tech CEOs, you're more outspoken on some of the social and political issues of this day. You wrote to the president-elect after he was elected, congratulating him on his win and then saying, listen, you have an opportunity here to do some great things for this country, but you were opposed to his candidacy. Why are you so outspoken?
Well, there are a few reasons. The letter to the president I wrote election week or right after the election, I wrote it first for myself. Now, it was a pretty emotional week for me. I'd lost my mother a couple of days before. She was 89. It was time for her to go, but I was still confronting sort of that story and working on writing an obituary for her at the same time. Then we get the election that hits, and I think, okay, well, this is not what any of us anticipated. But accept reality. He's won. He has the support of the folks who voted in the election. What would I realistically recommend that he do, given the platform he has and the support that he got? And so I did it partly for myself, just to think through what my advice would be. And I think the next reason is for our people. And this is why I speak out most frequently. We have about 750,000 people who wear our name badge every day around the world. They are as diverse as any society in every possible respect. But they are curious about what the world, developments in the world, mean for them personally, mean for their work, mean for the industry that they work in. I was hearing instantly from many of our folks, what does Trump's election mean? Maybe from some communities, I'm frightened by the election. I'd like to get some sort of connection with the company, with our CEO, about how do we think about it and what does it mean for us. And only lastly, and it would be a distant third, was it the notion that maybe I could influence what President Trump would do. I'm not sure I could say after almost a year that there's been any influence from that letter. But nevertheless, I think many thousands of folks in our system said, Arnie, we're glad you wrote because it gives us an insight into the way you think about it and the way you might try and use your influence going forward.
So that's the moral case, I suppose. In a business sense, as a guy running the biggest hotel company in the world now, how worried are you about America's reputation in the world, about our openness to international travel and international guests, and the willingness of other companies in which you do a whole lot of business to participate in this economy?
Yeah, it is concerning. We obviously have a new travel ban, the third version this week. It's a bit different than the last two. We are constantly looking at data, particularly about international arrivals to the United States. It looks like we're losing ground, not surprisingly, to the rest of the world. When you look at the world as a whole, what you've got is a growing tidal wave of new travelers coming out of China, coming out of the developing world. And where do they want to go? They want to go to the places that they've read about, that they've seen depicted in movies. By and large, that is Europe and the United States. The United States, at the same time, is sending a message which is less than a open arms welcome. And as a consequence, you're seeing folks around the world say, you know what, I think I won't go to the United States today. Now, the challenge, of course, that's not good for our business, and I can't pretend to be unbiased. But even put aside our selfish interests, that costs us jobs in the United States. It costs us tax revenue in the United States. It costs us all sorts of things which are good for us selfishly. And so I don't argue with the notion that we've got to make sure we get security right and we get immigration right. Those are important policy questions. But we can do those things and still communicate a welcome to the rest of the world, because 99% of the folks who want to come stay here present zero risk to us. We should instead be saying, how do we make sure that they come and stay here take their vacations, do their business here, leave their money here, whether it be in hotels or restaurants or shops or investments that they're making, and then go home. We'll have a better relationship and a stronger economy for it.
When you look at growth for this company and opportunities for people to come and stay in your places, do you look for Americans, or is it sort of the rising Chinese middle class? Is it maybe people from South America? Who is it?
It is a totally global business. We're in 120 countries roughly today. And just as an example, China is obviously a really very interesting market. We have about 40 hotels open in the city of Shanghai.
Whew.
Shanghai obviously is the most international city of the big Chinese cities. It is the New York of China, commercial capital. You might think that when you went to a Marriott hotel in downtown Shanghai, you would find mostly Americans or mostly Europeans coming in. It's mostly Chinese.
Yeah, no, it is. I've been to Marriott hotels in downtown Shanghai.
Chinese.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And that's the case. You go around the world, and of course, each market is a little bit different, but we are in most markets with local nationals running those hotels, staffing those hotels, welcoming their people as guests more than anybody else. Obviously, you've got the United Nations happening in most of these hotels, too.
Yeah. Last year, you spend $13-something billion to buy Starwood.
Correct.
To make you the biggest hotel company on the planet. Why did you need that deal?
Well, it was a number of factors came into it together. One, it was available. and that's a pretty serious comment, because when you look at powerful platforms in our industry, they become available only maybe once every 10 or 20 years.
Huh.
It's not as if these opportunities grow on trees.
Right.
And so here was a company that was for sale. The hardest thing about getting any deal done is, does the seller want to sell? And here you had a process set up. This was available. And so it was essential that we take a look at it. As the process went forward, the economics got more compelling to us because of the relative values of the companies. We knew we'd be using our stock to acquire Starwood, and so that relative valuation is hugely important to it.
I should point out here, you were an M&A guy in Marriott when you started, right?
I've done a lot of deals.
This is your lingua franca. I've done a lot of deals
and looked at Starwood many times over the 20 years or so I've been at Marriott and understood something about it. But the third and the most strategically interesting piece here is that we believe in the competitive world we live in, which is changing very quickly with technology companies that are trying to be active in our business, that our loyalty, that our loyalty
what I love
program.
Is you call Airbnb a technology company trying to be active in our business.
No, I'm thinking about a portfolio much bigger than just Airbnb. This is Expedia, Priceline, Google, C-Trip, Alibaba, all sorts of technology platforms, which are not necessarily offering an alternative product, but they want to be in the middle of our relationship with our customers. The biggest tool we have is the loyalty program.
Yeah.
How do we know you when you're traveling? How do we make sure that you know it's in your interest to stay with us because of the points you earn, the free vacation, the way we can customize marketing to you, all these other things? And by putting Starwood and Marriott together, now with 100 million members of the combined loyalty programs, we've got a moat around our castle, if you will, that allows us to say, these are our customers. We can grow with them in a way that doesn't insulate us from competition. You can't do that. But it does arm us for competition much better than we'd be without it.
But you're like twice the size of Hilton now, right? I mean, you're twice the size of your closest competitor.
We're 50 or 60% bigger.
Okay,
yeah.
I mean, size matters.
Size matters.
Yeah.
Yep.
To get to those technology companies trying to get in the middle of your relationship with your customer, who then is your threat? Are you not worried about Airbnb in 15 years and them changing the hotel business? Is it Google? I mean, I guess you can fight all of them, but you got to prioritize.
Airbnb obviously will be a competitor forever. They've built a great platform, very interesting, millions of listings, nominally more rooms than we have in our system.
Oh, interesting.
Our rooms, of course, are full just about every night. Yeah, their rooms are not even available every night, so the business model is quite different.
Yeah.
And their product varies dramatically. I think some of the product is really offered to be cheaper, essentially.
Yeah.
We don't ever want to be the cheapest provider of lodging services. We want to be a quality provider of lodging services.
Interesting thing to say. You don't want to be the cheapest provider of lodging services.
We're not in the budget space. We're not in the economy space. We're delivering experiences which people can count on.
yeah,
and where they want to come back to us and have those experiences.
But you do have, I mean, here we are in the Ritz, right? I'm not staying here. I'm staying at a Marriott property, you know, 2.5, 3 right. blocks away, the Courtyard, which is a number of levels down.
Yeah.
You slice and dice your customer base pretty finely with varying degrees of, I guess, fanciness available to them. Do you worry about slicing them too thin, especially now with the Starwood properties?
Well, you've got to be mindful of what the brands stand for. But the basic idea, we've got 70 hotels in Manhattan open.
And seems so like a lot of hotels.
Depending on the purpose of your trip might decide how much you want to spend.
Yep.
Is your company paying for it? Are you paying for it personally? Are you traveling with family members? Are you traveling with a group?
Yeah.
What part of the city do you want to be in? What kind of design do you want? Do you want to be at a W or a Ritz-Carlton or a Courtyard? You're going to find a range of choices, and we want to be there no matter the purpose of that trip for you and no matter what your desires are. So you can live within our portfolio, have that loyalty, be recognized, and know that it's in your interest.
Just to a couple of things that are on sort of the national agenda right now. One, immigration. Obviously, we've spoken about that. The other big thing going on in Washington right now is tax reform. How interested, how vested are you? How big a thing is that for you in Marriott's hierarchy of things to get taken care of?
It is, I think, is hugely important for the U.S. economy and for American companies, maybe at the moment a little bit more important than Marriott, for Marriott, because every public American company is worth more owned overseas than it's worth owned in the United States today because of our corporate tax policy.
Explain that a little bit.
So look at us. We're doing business in 120 countries around the world. We today, the money we make outside the United States, for us to bring it home requires us to pay up to the U.S. corporate tax rate, no matter where that money's been earned. On average, we're paying 20 cents a dollar on foreign income in foreign locations. Mm-hmm. If we brought it back to the United States, we'd essentially pay another 20% just to bring the money home. If by
net the loopholes and deductions and all that stuff, right? I mean, nobody's paying
35%. This is net of all the deductions.
All right.
This is under current tax policy.
Yep.
If we were owned in London, we could bring all of our money home and never pay that penalty. So that if, and this certainly was relevant in the Starwood acquisition, for example. Starwood's, our rival bidder was a Chinese bidder. If Chinese bidder is thinking about bringing money back to China, they'd lose less to tax authorities than Marriott would lose by acquiring Starwood. And again, we stand out alone. Our tax rates are higher. Corporate tax rates are higher. But our territoriality is a big deal. And as a consequence, I think we're seeing, it's hard to get the data, I think we're seeing lots and lots of new startups who have global aspirations make their domicile not in the United States, but in some other market, because it's crystal clear that that is economically advantageous to them. And until we change our tax policy, we're not going to get those companies to the list in the U.S.
Without implying that you agree with him on some other issues, that's basically Paul Ryan spiel. We're going to get tax reform done because we have to get it done for this economy.
Yeah. Now, the politics are tortuous.
Yeah.
Personally, I think the politics are much better if we say let's lower corporate tax rates and let's get rid of corporate tax expenditures.
Right.
So we come up with something which is much more revenue neutral.
Right.
That allows Democrats and Republicans to say, okay, let's fix the problem. Yeah. And not necessarily blow a hole under the waterline in our fiscal situation, or get into the apportionment of tax dollars between various classes in society.
Not to get too far afield, but you are a guy with political opinions running a major American corporation. Do you have faith in the Congress and the executive branch in this country to get these things done?
I have enormous faith and optimism in the United States. I think the next few years...
So do I, but that wasn't the question.
I think the next few years can be very complicated. Right now, the self-interest of way too many of our politicians, self-interest means how do they get reelected, is not driving them towards solving problems. It's driving them towards taking a position. And even the results of the primary last night...
In Alabama, Roy
In Alabama, sort of confirm that. Don't reach a hand across the aisle. Instead, stake out a position which is as extreme as it can be. We got to find a way where we can put that behind us.
You've been in this job 5 years, plus or minus.
Yeah.
let's say you hang around for another 15. What does this industry look like when you're done?
This industry is a spectacular one. Now, it will become increasingly global. It will increasingly wrap in experiences outside of the hotel, planning for the things you're going to do when you go to various destinations. The technology will continue to become more and more intuitive and prevalent with a community of loyalists and the rest who will be a sort of a travel community, if you will. But when you look at trends, part of this is aging of baby boomers. Part of it is wealth demographics. Part of it is the way the developing world is moving. All of us are wanting more experiences and less stuff. Not that we aren't still interested in some stuff.
Yeah,
we are.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're sharing on Instagram or Snap or whatever travel and dining. It is the consumption that we are turned on by. And I think we'll be there to grow with folks as they say, okay, what are the parts of the world I want to see? What are the food and beverage experiences I want to have? What kind of design do I want to experience, whether I'm in New York or in Shanghai?
There's a demographics part of this job, right? Aging baby boomers, millennials now, the biggest by percentage chunk of the American population and around the rest of the world. How closely are you focused on what, you know, the rising generation wants?
Well,
because it ain't necessarily the Ritz, right?
We are. It's interesting. I could go on way too long on this. I was sitting on a plane though 5 years ago, maybe from New York to Shanghai, and I was, of course, reading, trying to stay awake.
Trying to stay awake, right?
And reading various reports, including one in front of me was a Ritz-Carlton report from the prior month,
yeah.
Right? So I was looking at margins
and rent
and all the
right?
rest of it.
Come on.
And a young Chinese, I'd say maybe 25, fellow was sitting across the aisle, and he stood up at some point, and he said, "Do you work for Ritz-Carlton?" I said, "Yeah, I do."
In a way.
He pulled out his computer, and he showed me a page for every Ritz-Carlton he had stayed in the last 18 months.
Wow.
22 of them.
Wow.
And the lesson here is we are at our peril if we assume all millennials have a sort of monolithic point of view. Not true. They are as different from one from another as boomers are from one from another, or generations are from one from another. And actually what we think we see is all of us are more interested in the way technology works. We're more interested in design. We're more interested in quality food and beverage. We're more interested in the intensity of experience. I'm exactly the same way. I'm 58 years old. I wish I could say I'm a millennial, but can't.
Yeah.
And so those trends, I think, are mindset trends more than generational trends, but they are important trends, which we want to tap.
Not that this is necessarily relevant to anything, but... you were born in Japan. I wonder how much that experience of having been born outside this country shaped how you view your job today.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It may. One thing that's interesting to watch travelers, watch American business people travel.
Yeah.
Sometimes people in our own company, sometimes other companies. Many... intellectually understand the importance of the global business,
yeah.
but don't really love it. They find it wearying. They miss their local food, whatever it is they like the most. I love it. It is the most interesting part of the work I do is to hear from people in the United States, but around the world, what's important to you? How does your society work? How do we intersect with it? And maybe a piece of that is having spent time overseas. I don't know.
Arnie Sorensen, thanks a lot.
You bet. Nice to be with you, Kai.
That was the CEO of Marriott, Arnie Sorensen. Thanks for listening to the Corner Office Podcast. As always, leave us a review, would you, on Apple Podcasts. Those 5-star reviews, they really do help. The 1-stars, not so much, really. If you want to hear more from CEOs in the travel industry, take a look back at our archives. We've got people like Brian Chesky at Airbnb and the former Expedia CEO, Derek Khosrowshahi, now at Uber, right? This episode was produced by Bridget Bodner. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. We're back next week. Thanks a lot.